Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the Awaken Call for this week, May 20th, 2017. I'm going to move us back off of hold shortly. And hello again, everyone. My name is Birju, and I will be the host for this week's Global Awaken Call. Thank you so much for joining us. The purpose of these calls is about sharing stories and telling stories. These are stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society and fostering our own inner transformation in the process. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life, people who inspire us through their actions to live a more service-oriented way. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold the space. Today, our special guest speaker is Josera Gonzalez, and he is living a word that I have rarely heard, relevution, and look forward to having him be able to share a bit more about that. Thanks again for joining, and let's start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves in an intention of listening. Thank you.
Thank you.
And welcome again today in conversation with Josera Gonzalez. So here's how the call works. I will be shortly handing it off to our moderator, Rina Patel, who will engage in a dialogue with Josera. And by the top of the hour, we will shift over to question and answer and invite people who are calling in to share their comments, reflections, or inquiries with Josera and engage in a circle of sharing. Of course, it's not required to do that, but we would invite all of your reflections, and if you're a first-time caller, just to share your name. I've opened up the queue as of right now, so at any point, you can hit *6 on your phone, and you will be prompted to share even at the top of the hour. You could even do it in 5 minutes, and we'll just have you in the queue for the top of the hour. If you prefer not to speak, but you'd still like to ask a question, you can also email us. And the email address is ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. And I will remind us of this as we get closer to the Q&A part as well. So, as you mentioned, the theme for this week is Relevution in Spain, which, as I understand it, is really about creating the conditions for social emergence. I have a friend and colleague in this broader space, and she uses the phrase to hospice the old and midwife the new, which to me is a really beautiful process of even inquiring into what is the old and what is the new. And so since we have the pleasure of our remarkable moderator, Rina Patel, I thought that she might be able to start us off in that conversation. To give you a little bit of context, Rina is a volunteer with Service Space. I know her through one of the service-based programs that we were both involved in a couple years ago called Laddership. But aside from that, she is involved with several nonprofits, including starting her own that's based in India, and is a recent graduate of Drexel University, where she was also a student leader. Rina, please take over.
Thanks, Birju. So I think I first wanted to start this call off with a story about Josera and then go a little more into his introduction and then sort of just jump right in into what the revolution really is. About a year ago, Josera and I and another friend from Spain were traveling to Nepal by train from Ahmedabad, India. And we were on this, I think, 45-hour train journey, and the first leg of it, I think, was about 20 hours or something. And I remember it was me, Josera, and a friend, Nikki, and Everyone initially was always just kind of looking at us, and they're a little skeptical of us. And, you know, who are these two tall men who kind of stand out of the crowd on this train? And initially, I remember Josera had recommended we do this informal awaken circle, and then sort of go into this dialogue with the other people who are kind of sitting around us on the train. And it was so beautiful to see, because by the end of a couple of hours, everyone in that compartment had become so close, and we were playing games. And yeah, there was this huge language barrier, but it didn't seem like that. And I think that really exemplifies who Josera is as a person. He sort of brings his presence with him wherever he goes. And he really, whatever he does from the heart. And he's really brought that into the work, the social work that he's doing in Spain. And really, whenever he travels all over the world, he was recently in Japan, and he was telling me about his experiences. And I'm sure that's also one of the places that he's really brought his spirit to and his presence. So I wanted to jump right into things with Josera and just ask him a little more about what a revolution is, and what this title, why it's so important in the work that he's doing. So Josera, I'll hand it off to you.
Thank you so much for that showering of love, Andrina G. Yes, I'm very excited about this call. I'm very dear friend of Awakening Calls, and with you and many of the people who possibly, I don't know who is there at the other end, but I'm sure I'm friends with many of you. So I'm glad we are together having this conversation. I'm not used to talk to a computer without a face. So let's see what comes out of this. I have actually here in my room, I'm not in my room actually, I'm in Madrid. So I've tried to decorate my friend's room with some human stuff, you know. I had some pictures, and I have a peace ball here. So I try to do my best. I think revolution for me, one of the main things that which is happening now is that I had an experience in India of 2 years of volunteer work, and I was touched by many of the things I could see there. I can say that I haven't received so much love ever. I love my family, but even in my biological family, you know, sometimes we don't have those unconditional experiences of love. And in India, it really touched me deeply how people treated me, how everyone gave me everything without expectations. I'm sure during the call we'll go through few of the experiences, but the revolution comes. I'm glad you can pronounce the name Biju. I think you are the first person in US that can pronounce it. But really, it is. I think it is about this. How can I bring this spirit of love to my spaces, wherever I am, in small or big ways? And I think in Spain we have a need of this. I think everywhere. I mean. And it's not even a need. Our nature is this. So how can we spread this love in many different ways? So this is the revolution. I think we have a lot of experiments, like the retreats we are having. We just had one 3-day retreat, head, heart, and hands, we say. And people left the retreat like we were talking about different kinds of poverty and different kinds of wealth. And people left the retreat feeling much richer in many ways. So I think that's the intention behind all what we do in Relocution.
Mm. Wow. And there are some really beautiful things that you touched on in terms of people leaving feeling richer, and also of how you had a lot of experiences with unconditional love when you're in Gandhi Ashram. Can you also tell us a little more about what you did in Gandhi Ashram and what led you to spending 2 years there?
So, yeah, I think I have to say thank you to my brother, Jesus, who might be listening this in Kenya. He was there as an architect working for Manasatna, one of the most beautiful NGOs I know. They do amazing work supporting the journeys of underprivileged people in the slums. They work with thousands of people every day and always with a smile, always with that sense of also not only service, but how can I change myself in that process? So I was lucky or not lucky, I don't know, to be connected with Jesus. We became really good friends in Amsterdam, and he was doing this small practice. He has a lot of beautiful small practices, and one of those practices was to send emails to all his friends and family, sharing that. And all his emails were so touching, so touching. And I could feel, I was working in an NGO here in Spain, and I could feel that there was a lot of coherence in what he was saying. Like this duality that we are talking about, inner transformation and service, this, there has to be something else, you know? There has to be a place where people see each other very kindly. Yeah.
Sorry, yes? you just cut out for about 5 seconds there. Could you repeat that, please?
Yeah. So I was saying that in Spain, in this NGO, it didn't feel very coherent, was not there. So there was this hierarchy, for example. People were not, didn't have very good manners with the volunteers sometimes. People were not smiling, basically. So, but the stories that Jesus was sharing, I think were all about how can we serve the world, but how can we also become better people? So it really called me to go there, and I think that's kind of, I don't know if it's my karma, but it led me to the Gandhi Ashram to have all the beautiful experiences I had.
Wow, really beautiful. And you mentioned that there are so many people who shower this unconditional love on you. Who are some of those people that left a deep imprint on your heart?
I think many. I mean, I have to say Yashvai, definitely. Many of you know probably, he's one of the coordinators at the Gandhi Ashram, and he is also leading other organizations that work for service. And I remember I have been skeptical with the energy issues, with the energy things, but when I entered the Gandhi Ashram, I felt there was something different in that place. And I think I can say the same about Yashvai. He's the first person I met that when I met him, I felt like, oh, there is something special about this person, which is invisible. And yeah, he, just by being there, you know, his presence, his motherly and fatherly love, I really felt embraced by him, and I'll be always grateful. I felt there was a lot of space to be myself, to try, to practice, to experiment with things. So one person is him. Another person, of course, is Brother Nipun. I'm not going to talk too much about him because we know. But he has been a lighthouse for me in many ways. And he was there in the time I was there. He was there for 4 or 5 months. So also the way he's, I remember him talking to everyone. He talks to everyone in the same way. So he almost had like a queue waiting for him to talk. But then he put the same intention and the same attention to every moment. So that mindfulness was also very touching and very inspiring. Then, of course, my brother Nemo and Siddharth and Madhu and so many other people, Guri, I can say hundreds of names. But I think you can feel in the whole ashram, you can feel that the spirit very much alive. And I think these people who are living there are very responsible for that renaissance of Gandhian spirit, not only in the ashram, but in the world. It's so beautiful how it's spreading to so many of us, so many organizations and movements. And yeah, again, it's a lighthouse for so many people. So I'm so glad I fell into their laps. And yes, I love them.
Wow, really beautiful. And I think we've had a lot of conversations around this before, about this bringing these values that you felt and you experienced in India, and sort of bringing the East to the West, which has really kind of influenced your work. Many of your experiences in India and in Gandhi Ashram have really sort of solidified this this intention of bringing these Eastern values to the West and bringing them to your communities in Spain. Can you tell maybe us a little more about how this shift happened when that kind of period came where you felt you were ready to go back to Spain and start these experiments there?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll answer that. I want to share also a little story of the ashram. Is that okay?
Yeah, completely fine.
So, yeah, I want to share it because I've shared this story, but I think it has to be here. And I was working for, I was doing an experiment on gardening in the slums. Actually, I remember, I was remembering how Biju and I were walking together. We were visiting that garden, and we started few gardens in the slums with this idea of how can the gardens be a space for the community, for conversation, for harmony in these places which are very tough for the soul. So we underwent few experiments, and in many of them I received so much. I received so many things. But in one of them, I remember we had this beautiful story talking about how generous and lovely people are in India. We had this gathering, I think it was 8 months after we started the garden, where we were like harvesting all the fruits and vegetables for the first time. And this family, they were saying like, you know, we would love to get the fruits for us because we struggle with life every day. But you know, we want to give it to you. We want to give it to the volunteers. So we were, all of us were in tears there, like, wow, this is, you know, where is this generosity coming from? And I think that that's just one example, but I felt that constantly in these communities, that they have a tremendous capacity to give love in so many ways. So just wanted to bring that. From the ashram as well. and then to your question, I don't know if I'm ready yet to be here. I still feel that I'm out of my mother's womb, in that sense, because it's hard, you know. We have a very strong machine which is going in one direction, which is consuming and polluting the environment. And there is also a lot of lack of empathy in many ways. So there is this big engine which is going in one direction, also in Spain. And it's challenging to be here sometimes, but I felt I could do something. And this is my culture. Some people say that we are born where we are born for a reason. So I'm working with that. I'm working with the conditions that we have. And as we say in service space, I think it's about trying to amplify the good. So although we are poor in many ways, we might be poor in Europe. I think we are rich in different ways. So how can we amplify all those richness? We try to do that.
And I know we've talked about, you know, amplifying the good through gift and this sort of this paradigm shift from consumption to contribution. So maybe if you can tell us about your experiences living on gift and sort of what also drove you to feel to live that way in general.
Yeah, it's an experiment. I think I'm experimenting. I'm trying to follow what it feels alive for me. So when I had this experience with the garden in India, I had the power of offering everything as a gift. I could see the reaction of people and my own reaction. It unlocked different kind of dynamics. I think, for example, in another garden, this family, they have resources. So we were working with slum families, but also with families with material resources. And after the whole process of building the garden, they were so open to the volunteers. You know, they were opening their home, they were inviting us for dinner, they were connecting us with other people who could want to create a garden. They were telling us, oh, you should connect with this government official that they are creating this education program, so maybe you can fit some gardens in there. So this whole different dynamics where a lot of other things or capitals that are hidden suddenly appear. So we had a lot of that, and I think for me also my heart was happy when it's happy when I offer things this way. So it's kind of regenerating. I don't know if I will be living as a volunteer for many more years, who knows? But for now it's unlocking a lot of different possibilities. And I have, again, I have so many stories I can share on this. For example, do you want me to share one?
Yeah, of course.
For example, recently there is a friend of us who is undergoing his last part of a drug addiction program. And we have very good connections. So he came to one awakening circle, and since then he has been coming all the time. He told me one day, oh, I have this problem in my back, so I can also give massages. I'm a physical therapist by profession. So I said, yeah, come home and we'll have a conversation. And he, you know, he doesn't have that much money right now. So I knew, and all this I do as a gift, the physical therapy treatments as well. So I just offered the treatment, and he was very happy after the whole thing, not only because of the massage, but because of the conversation and the space he found there. And also he was struck by the money thing, no? How, just like people offering something like that, he couldn't really believe that much. So I think, many, many experiences like that I had.
Wow. And you mentioned opening up your home, and I know this is something that you started to do with Awakened Circles. How retreats are also being kept in a village close by to where you live currently. But maybe if you can tell us a little bit, because I feel I've had the opportunity to experience the level of transformation that opening, you know, that you've kind of created in terms of opening up your home and your heart to other people. But can you tell us a little more about maybe what has happened in your village home and your home in Burgos, and how that has sort of created a shift in the community that you're living in?
I think I have to talk about my parents, because they have been such an example for many of us. I think it's amazing, like we now a lot of friends from India or different places come. And they've always been super open with their home. Like, I think our people in the village, they always understood the home as the community home. And it's because of them. They've been having that clarity, you know, that, oh, we just have to keep the door open, you know, which, again, is kind of counterintuitive right now. But they said, no, we have to, everyone is welcome and we'll serve everyone. And so in my village home, it's like that. It's because of them, because they have been always super, super open and flexible. And I think, yeah, I've learned a lot from people like Pancho, you know, who lives in this, they say, the dangerous place, and he still keeps the door open for everyone. Even if there are gunshots in the street, he still keeps that door open. So I think people like them encourage me to try to practice that trust. I think that's another change shift that we talk about. No, how can we increase our trust in others? For example, with my bicycle, I have this experiment of not locking it, and it has been a few years that I don't have any problem with that. So, I think in small ways, I try to practice that.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear other stories, because there's this theme that has been emerging of isolation to community as you've been speaking. I'm curious to hear other stories that you might have, whether it's relating to opening your home with Awaken or your parents inviting others to your village home. I'm curious to hear other experiences or stories of isolation to community.
Yeah, I think one good example in that sense is Karma Kitchen. Probably most of you know it's a gift economy restaurant. And the idea there is that, especially that, I think we work on more things, but that feeling of going from yourself to sharing the values together with other people is very powerful. In Karma Kitchen, it's so beautiful because it brings so much diversity together, from like 15-year-old kids to, I have my auntie who is 100-year-old, she comes there to serve too. So you have people working in banks, you have people working in NGOs, people more in social movements, people that meditate, people that don't meditate. You have a lot of mix there. And I think we have, for example, one thing we do is we have gatherings in the beginning where everyone shares their name at Karma Kitchen, and then they share, for example, why they are there. And that simple fact that they have a circle and they are looking to each other and they can open up, it brings up a lot of change, because we are not, I mean, if you think about education, for example, in the class, we usually see one face at the end and we see the backs of the people. In education, usually you spend like 7 years, 7 hours a day that way. So you are in a kind of isolated state. So when you have having these underlying values, it's very beautiful to see what happens. And a lot of people feel more resilient. I would say after, for example, Karma Kitchen, a lot of people feel they are richer in connection, richer in friendship, richer in community, richer in many ways. So, I feel all these experiments have a very component of that. How can we show people that we are not alone on this journey?
And I know in this... with this work that you're doing, it's in the community, it's very important for you to stay rooted. What are some personal practices that you have? I know you're a meditator and you have some other daily practices. What is it that really keeps you rooted in as you continue to work and as you continue to sort of bring your presence to different spaces?
I think friendship is very, very important. Like just being here, having this conversation with you, definitely it supports, you know, when you share from this space of opening your heart and learning together. I think friendship is not a practice, but it's something which is very powerful for my journey personally. And on practices, although I think every moment is an opportunity to practice, but of course meditation I do, I try to do 2 hours a day. It helps me. I definitely feel it makes a difference. Like when before meditating and after meditating, I remember this experience of going to our first 10-day course. And we were going in a car with five of us. We didn't know each other that much. So the conversation was just fine. I mean, we were not very open with each other. But then after the 10-day meditation, when we came back, we all were like brothers and sisters. You know, it was amazing. Mm-hmm. Like the shift in energy was very clear. And we were talking about this deep stuff, about our families, our relationships, and everything, just in a one ride, you know, 2 hour ride. And it made a huge difference. So I definitely feel it's helping me to improve in many ways. Yeah. I know you are a good meditator too, Rina.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think when I had first met you, I had just recently learned that you had spent seven months in the Vipassana Center. And I remember you telling me that this wasn't something that you had planned to do. You kind of just went there and then you found out that you could serve longer. But what made you stay for those 7 months? Because 7 months is a long time to spend in a center. So I'd love to hear more about that and your experiences staying there.
Yeah. I mean, I felt I had to do it. I went for the first course and I didn't know it was a possibility. I didn't know you could go and stay and do service for longer periods. So I discovered after that course, my first service course, actually. I discovered after that, and I was like, oh, this is what I have to do. When I came back from India, I felt I was not totally aligned with the values I wanted to work for. So, for example, when we talk about kindness or generosity or mindfulness, I think we cannot really preach anything. Like, we cannot force change onto people, you know, we cannot change anyone actually. But I think my experience is that as I go deeper, or when I see other people who have gone deeper in that sense, in changing themselves, I see how it really touches people in different ways. We cannot control how, but it really helps those good qualities to emerge on others too. So I felt I had to do more of that inner work to really be able to share my experience from India here. And I'm still in that process. I don't think I am a great example of anything, but I'm trying to build that up and to support other people's journeys. And the 7 months, it was a very, very tough experience the first 2-3 months, because it's like our mind is not used to so many hours of just sitting. And just being there, just watching your breath. So it was quite tough at the beginning, but then after a few months, like I think it was great investment, as I say. It was tough, but it's a great investment, and I can feel it now that it helped me a lot in many ways.
Wow. And you mentioned this bringing a different type of presence or an energy with you. And I know one of the experiences or one of the experiments that you guys have been doing, which sort of allows this presence or this energy to come up, is giving free hugs on the street. Can you tell us maybe a little bit about some of those experiments that you've been doing on the street with strangers and how that's sort of been a very transformative experience?
Yeah. Oh, yesterday we had an amazing experience, actually. We went to this Retiro Park in Madrid, and we saw Mickey Mouse, you know, these people who are dressed up to just make kids smile. And give them some balloons or anything or things like that. So we saw, it was kind of hot, and we saw he was sitting there. I was there with David, And we saw him there, and we were like, oh, maybe we can go. It emerged very spontaneously, you know. We were not planning to massage, but we ended up talking to him, and we were, oh, you look tired, you know. Do you want a massage? So we started to give him a massage. We were actually three of us. So David and I started, and then the other friend also joined. And he was like, he didn't have words. He was just staying there like, oh, it's so good, it's so good. Because, I mean, these people, I know he probably has like a tough day, you know, so many hours just there to get some, like, few euros, you know. So it really, I mean, it's not very common that you have these actions, I think, where you feel that a brother, like all the people you find in the street, I try to see it like that. I think they are brothers and sisters. So how can we make them smile, or how can we have these small details? So that the experience with Mickey was very, very powerful yesterday. And I think with the free hacks, it's kind of the same experiment. How can we, even if you know someone, how can you look at the other person as if you already know her? And it brings that feeling. It's really, it can look as a very superficial thing, but depending on how you do it, it can be a very deep thing, and you can connect with people just like that. So with the free hacks, we had a lot of experiences like that, where people just connect, or you just touch someone who is having a very tough day, and you just shift something in that person who might shift something in someone else, and then that person will shift something in many other people. So I believe there is a joy to these things, but there is also a depth to it, which makes it even more joyful. You were doing that in the Camino, actually.
Yeah,
Rina, for everyone to know, you know, Rina was doing the Camino de Santiago for 1 month. And she was hugging everyone in the streets. I think people in my city, in Burgos, they know her as the happiest, kindest Indian lady, I think.
Wow.
That's sort of what reminded me, because we were in Burgos on the street and giving free hugs. It was me, Josera, and another friend. And Josera was sort of picking out people, like, oh, go hug this person, go hug this person. That was a great experience. And yeah, you sort of segued into something I was thinking about earlier, was about how you live along the Camino de Santiago, which is it's this beautiful pilgrimage route that goes from France, from the Pyrenees, to the Atlantic Ocean on the westernmost coast of Spain. And I know you and I have had a lot of conversations about the Camino and how you sort of grew up in Burgos, which is a town where pilgrims are always coming in and out, and how in some ways it has really influenced you. And I maybe not consciously in the beginning as you were growing up, but definitely as you became a pilgrim yourself. You're recently in Brazil and in Giftable. You're recently in Japan. So I'd love to hear more about your experiences of being a pilgrim and bringing that spirit of being a pilgrimate with other pilgrim souls.
Yeah, I think Madhu says, maybe someone before him said, but, that there is a difference with when you are a traveler or a pilgrim. A traveler is someone who wants to get something. And a pilgrim is someone who wants to change himself and learn in that process. So sometimes I'm still a traveler. But yeah, I think it has been beautiful to be with so many pilgrims around the world. For example, this last week, we were in Japan. There is this beautiful family, the Sayonji family, who are promoting a culture of peace through many events for so many years. They are rooted in the after the situation of the Second World War. A few awakening people decided to start a prayer movement, prayer for peace movement, which went beyond religion, beyond our differences. And since then, they have been doing so many different events, because they do one thing which is called Symphony of Peace Prayers, where they gather Buddhist leaders, Muslim leaders, Christian leaders, or all religious leaders, and also people from this, and all the people, with also local Japanese people who go to pray for peace. It's like 10,000 people together, with that intention of sending good vibes to the world. And you are there for the whole day. We were there, like, on the guests. And it was really, it's very difficult to express it with words, but it was a wonderful feeling of oneness. I think for many, many years we have been waiting for these emergencies to happen, for this emergence where all our diversity, again, comes together. And they are just incredible people. All the amount of details that they had with us, on these little gifts, how they received us, so many things I could say about the Japan experience. But yeah, I'm so glad that my, as you say, my pilgrim experience has brought me to these spaces where I can learn so much from many, many people around the world. And it's nice to see that there are so many people who are going in different directions in this sense. So hopefully we can be more and more pilgrims in the planet.
When we were speaking, you were also telling me more about the peace for Mother Earth and peace for water. And I know that you are also in a way of environmental activist with your own practices of not using plastic, and really trying to promote peace on Earth through your own love for Earth. Can you maybe tell us a little more about some things that have created that love for Mother Earth and for nature in general?
I think in that sense, I haven't that much. I mean, I have done few experiments, like what you said, of not buying plastic or trying to go by bicycle everywhere. These things, I have that sensitivity. I feel I can do much more. Maybe this is a promise to myself, but I think we can all do much more. I think we are failing in that, like fighting climate change. And of course, all the problems we are having connected to nature are very much related to our culture. So we cannot dissociate the environmental issues with the social issues. And hopefully I can do more. I want to answer your question with this intention of really trying to serve more to Mother Earth. I think we still don't know how beautiful nature is. I think there are a lot of things which we don't understand totally, because our understanding will be higher when it's collective. So when more people have this understanding on how beautiful nature is, I think we'll unlock more of the gifts that it has for us. That's my feeling, and hopefully, yeah, I can raise more awareness on loving the earth. We are having this experiment, for example, which we call Peace Trees, and we are in the same spirit as the Sayonji family. We just in December we had our first peace tree, and the whole idea was just to gather around the tree to wish peace for the world. And we gathered for like 20 minutes of silence, and then we started to hang messages of peace in the tree with this beautiful origami paper. Actually, I didn't know I was going to go to Japan, but we had origami paper for that activity. And we were like 40, 50 of us. We didn't even reach out that much, but we ended up being 40 or 50. And it was a wonderful feeling of being again under the trees, being sharing stories, sharing a good intention. So I think when we are able to connect the environment issues and the environment environmental activism with some sense of spirituality and connection, I think our environmental movements will be much more empowered. I think we can do much more of what we are doing. We need that empathy with nature, but we need also to be to have some kind of spiritual spiritual ground, so we can be more efficient.
Wow. And that reminds me of this word. I don't know if you had made it up, but this word that you had told me once called meditaction, meditation and action put together. So it just reminded me of that. And so I had a few more questions, but I think you had easily kind of segued into something I was also thinking about as you're something that had come to mind was of how this, through all of these experiments and through your own personal practices and sort of staying rooted in yourself, this community has emerged in Burgos and in Madrid. And what do you feel are some next steps, or what do you think is emerging right now for you, whether it's personally or in the work that you're doing? What do you feel is coming to light?
Yeah, I think we'll keep having this head, heart, and hands retreat. We are having one in June. Yeah, one in June, one in August, one in September. We are having few, and I can feel how it's creating this sense of ecosystem, and people are really feeling the support that creating those novel connections, because this is one of the main things that happened there, that people connect. One girl was reflecting. She was like, wow, you know, I have all these friends for so many years, like 20 years of friendship, 25. But I came to this place, and in 2 days, I have a deeper connection to all of you. I feel we'll keep working with that, trying to create those spaces where people can connect with themselves and with others and with nature. Site where we have an amazing team of translators at Service Space, actually. People who are translating, like Maria, who is translating, who are translating things from California, or other friends. So we want to keep building up content in Spanish. Also, we are talking with Pavi to start translating all the daily good material. So I feel connecting those worlds. So all the offline projects like Karma Kitchen and retreats, Awakening Circles, and different experiments that will emerge with the online content is very powerful, because people really feel connected. They don't feel you go to a retreat and then what, you know? No, there is a sense of connection and interconnection. So we can create that feeling of an alive thing, a live ecosystem where people can connect. So I think that's one of the things, but of course many, many other things that I don't know will emerge for sure.
Yeah. And what were, as you've been kind of in this process of community and with these experiments, were there any challenges that you ran into along the way?
I'm always with this question, oh, should I go to Himalayas, you know? Of course, when you treat with people, you have all kinds of challenges coming up because hunger emerges, or greed emerges, or sadness emerges sometimes, or doubt emerges. So in these spaces, I think it's very, all of them are great challenges to oneself, because you are opening yourself in front of many people, and you have to stay balanced and rooted. So I think that's the main challenge. How can I, even if I'm active in the world and I'm trying to reach out, how can I stay rooted and peaceful? And because I think in the end, like when we interact with people, that's what stays. I think your state of mind, that's what stays with other people. So I think that's my main challenge. How can I be my best self all the time, even in the midst of any situation?
And are there any last words that you think would be you would like to leave our callers with, in terms of any lessons that you've learned through your own personal transformation or through the work that you've been doing these past couple of years?
I don't know. Maybe Bilju. I think Bilju has been listening so patiently. Maybe you want to share something, Bilju.
So your last words can't be my words, man.
Why not?
I would love to hear. I of course have a lot of questions on my side too, but I'd love to hear your reflections on this, Joseta.
Oh, okay. No, I feel I have no lesson to give. I hopefully with my life, you know, we can stay connected through my life, all of us that are in this call and whoever reads this. I feel we are at the verge of many changes. We are already living many changes, and I think if we stay together in this journey, we can really face this big current, which is taking us in a direction that we don't know, we don't want. So, yeah, I just hope that we all feel that we are holding hands in a journey of for more peace in the world, and more kindness and more generosity. And hopefully with every thought and with every action, we can add to that current of love. And yeah, as they say in Japan, may peace prevail on earth, and may peace prevail on our hearts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rina G.
Thank you so much. That was really beautiful. And I think now we're at the top of the hour. So Virgil,
yes.
I'll hand it over to you to see if there are any questions from callers.
Yes. So the intention for the remainder of our call is just to invite in callers with reflections or comments or questions, but also to continue this conversation. And so if you do have any reflections to share, please do call in. And the way to do that is by pressing *6, and you can enter the queue that way. The other way that you can ask a question is through email, and that is through emailing ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. And otherwise, we can continue along here. And of course, I'll let Joseta and Rina know if questioners come in. But otherwise, I'd love to jump in and ask a couple questions, if I may, Joseta.
Yes, please, my friend.
Wonderful. So the original context in which I met you was in Ahmedabad, where you were doing these organic garden options for the people who live in these slums. And I would love to know a bit more about your connection with the land, and how has your understanding of being in service to land grown and changed over time as you have learned more about what that even means?
I feel, again, I'm in the kindergarten in that sense. I felt deeply moved. I was in this last trip to India. I was there for 3 months from January to March. And actually, Rina was there too in Auroville. We were in this place called Auroville, which
yep.
it's a town whose mission is how can we realize human unity. I was so happy because they, in the 50s or 60s, they started to create the city, and it was a barren land. It was like completely empty. And now it's all green. It's like a forest, amazing, so green. And it makes me feel alive, you know, when I'm walking in a place where all is green. And I think all of us have that need of going to a park sometimes, or going to the nature sometimes, to the forest. So in that sense, I think we haven't been very smart on designing the cities. I think that's one problem I can see in the world nowadays, that it's not designed for our realization and happiness. But I feel this part of nature, it should be more integrated. And I think Auroville, for example, is a great example in that sense. And I can feel that, you know, I can feel when I'm near a big tree, I can feel that connection. With the farming again, when you eat organic food, you can feel there is something different. So it's very alive in me, yes.
So I'm curious about what that means in terms of, you know, how do you feel like serving nature is best done, right? So when you're with people in the slums, there's only so much, you know, organic kind of things you could do. And so, you know, to what extent do you feel like you're limited when you may want to do natural farming or permaculture, but limited in the circumstances? So how do you determine what's the best way to connect land to people, given all these unique circumstances?
Yeah, I think probably you remember the story of Raghu Bhai, who he was giving, he was an amazing friend who couldn't move his legs. He had polio when he was a child. So, and he lived in the slums, and he wanted to do something. He said, I want to do some service, even if I have not my, like, movable legs. I cannot move my legs, but I still want to serve. So he said, okay, I'm gonna go to everyone's home, and I'm going to give a tulsi plant. This is one of the projects he had. And tulsi, of course, is a very sacred plant in India. But he was moved to do that. And I think even if it's a small plant, it makes a difference in the slums. When you see that small bit of green, I think it awakens something. It's that feeling of that that concept of when there is beauty outside, it helps your inner beauty. So I think the gardens, even if it's one plant, it can help to bring about your own beauty too.
Thank you for that additional context. And we have a question from Greg in Ahmedabad, and he was curious about the term Relevution. How old is it? When did you first connect with it?
Yeah. Thank you, Greg. I love you, brother. So I heard, I think, in Ahmedabad, actually, in 2012, maybe, through a friend, Andrea, who she saw me a picture. She was, I think, on the wall. And there was like Re and then Love in red, and then Fusion. So it stayed with me, you know, how beautiful that concept is. And I think it speaks a lot about what we are doing here, which is trying to create bridges between the inner world and the outer world. But we need a revolution with love. So I love that. I don't know if it's fully understandable.
We are part of it, right? We get to create new words.
Yeah. It's true. But we are open to change.
Did we lose you, Josera?
Sorry?
Okay, you're back. So was that, were you finished answering the question?
Yes.
Okay. I'm curious if you could share a bit more about, you know, your humanity, right? The other side of you. I'm curious if you could share some fears or concerns that you have, and when you walk this path of constant unconditional service, you know, what comes up inside? What boundaries of you know, your own limitations do you come across?
Yeah, I think one of the fears I have, probably the biggest, is am I doing my best? I think many people who are in the service journey have this, and personally I have this sometimes, because I had some spiritual experiences where I could see with clarity what I had to do next. Like, okay, now you have to serve this way, or clearly. But we are not always in that space. I'm not always in that space where I can see clearly what I have to do next. So that's a bit of my fear, that I spend time or I do things that, or yeah, I disconnect from my true purpose. So I think that's also where meditation is very helpful, because I feel the more I have my own practice, the more I can connect to my own true purpose. So yeah, that's a little bit of a fear with you.
And can I want to invite you into, I'm going to call it the shadow. So what are the potential issues that you've seen that could come with leading with this edge of kindness and compassion? Where have you seen, you know, your own concerns come up in terms of missing something, in terms of going into your own dark night, in terms of going to places that bring up, you know, real struggle inside of you, or have you seen that with others?
Yeah. I think one challenge is to find our own truth. I think when we are, maybe this is a challenge we have in the collective spaces, that we might have the best of our intentions and our best generosity, but we are connecting with other people. So sometimes in those collective dynamics, we might, for example, create leaderships which are not useful for us, for example, or we might start to silent, making like silently, I don't know how to express it in English, but not listening to our own voice, and listening more to other people, no? So there is a balance. For example, that's an edge. How much in the collective is people who seem that they have everything clear, and how much do we listen to our own voice, our own inner truth? How much do we follow our own intuitions, you know? So that, I think that's a balance, that's an edge that we can see in many of the social movements we are involved with.
I appreciate that as context. I'd love to hear a bit more about what you're seeing happening in the whole world around this topic. You're this rare kind of person who's not only engaging with such deep love, but you've been globetrotting along the way, whether that's, you know, doing this gathering in Japan, or I hear of this Giftable movement where you've gone to their conference gatherings, which is all about exploring this questioning of how to live in the space of gift. And so what are you seeing out there? You know, is this a wonderful thing that you are doing in combination with Service Space and Moved by Love, or is this happening elsewhere?
Yeah, I think it's we always talk in the book about this, that it's not so much about organizations or close groups, but more about this feeling that we are all working in the same direction. So I've been blessed to, for example, to be invited to Giftival last year or to Japan this year. And I can see there is the same spirit. I think it's very rich. For me, it has been very rich to see the differences, how people hold circles and what's the main intention. In Giftival, for example, one of the most beautiful things I found is that there was this sense of celebration. So they were saying, like, it's a collective inquiry on gift, but with celebration, you know? So we are We are reflecting. We are also contemplating. We have a space for contemplation, for reflection, for sharing, but also there is a space for celebration. And I think Gandhi said, you know, that, like, without sense of humor, I long ago have committed suicide. And I think a lot of spiritual people can tell you that, that sense of humor is a key piece of this. So, for example, Gistival gave me that, that perspective. Also, the indigenous wisdom, they brought people from North America, from the Lakota tradition. They brought people from the Amazon, people from Africa. So also, I think looking back to the to this beautiful indigenous wisdom, it's so heavy. This lady, Pat McCabe from the Lakota tradition, she shared a prayer when all the rage was happening at Standing Rock. We were there in Brazil, and she shared a beautiful prayer where she included not only the people who were harmed, but also the people who were harming others. Because she was saying, like, and she was crying during that prayer. It was very deep for her. And she was feeling compassion not only for the aggression, but for, I mean, also for the people who were aggressing other people. It was so beautiful to see. So, yeah. And yes, I don't know if I'm answering the question or if I'm going to the branches.
Well, it sounds like you're saying that it is happening elsewhere in the world. And then when you call out this question or this inquiry around humor, I wanted to go deeper into that because to me, it is a little bit of a paradox because part of the reason, as I understand it, that you're doing all of this work is because you see what may be considered as issues or things that you'd like to change in society. And so here you're looking at the social structure and saying, wow, you know, there is profound, you know, disharmony that is out there. How can you find a space for humor through that, right? It's easy to find things funny when one is, call it, more ignorant. But if ignorance is lessened, you know, and you're still finding things to be in a space of humor, how does that happen?
Yeah. I think, of course, there are that's the balance. I think that's another edge that you are talking about. So one, of course, we need to be serious about many of these things. But also, when we are, for example, with real situations, that sense of humor is always like a tool, which for me it has been very, very useful. Even if I'm treating with people that are suffering all these conditions that you are talking about, they are suffering, and we can connect, of course, first with empathy, and for example, the quality of listening, it's very helpful, and giving a space for people to express whatever is alive in them, all that suffering that they are having. But then always in the conversations, like in all the real situations, the sense of humor always jumps in somehow. So you might have that first moment of, I remember being in the train and we found this guy who was begging, and he was so sad. He was begging and crying all the time. He was acting like that, but I think it was part of his being already. And he, after some time, like, he sat with us, and we had a very nice conversation. We involved people on the train. And, you know, there was this listening that I was talking about, and this just being with him and creating space for him. But then after some time, we jumped into smiles, and we jumped into different kind of connection, more based on in joy. So I think it's a very, for me, it has been a very useful tool. And it keeps coming. It's not that I force it, but it keeps coming to this situation. And I think, again, you can say at the collective level or even at the systemic level, I think it's a great tool.
And I had a question around, it seems that you've brought in a lot of this feeling of enough an abundance of love and an abundance of care and just everything that you do, and how you're trying not to see or live in a scarce way. How are you unlocking different forms of capital in your own life in addition to what you've shared? I know, like, spiritual capital and emotional capital, but how are you really trying to unlock those different forms of capital and that love in everything that you do?
I think it's happening. For example, you know, with the flat that my auntie, I think it's funny because with this, I mean, we have so many things which are there and we don't use them. In Spain, for example, we have like 4 million houses, 4 million homes which are empty. Or we throw away 7.7 million tons of food every year. And so many other resources that we just waste them, because maybe one of the reasons is because we don't have enough connections to share those. It's one way to look at it. So I think when we create those connections, all those capitals which are there, then they appear. And for example, I'm living in a flat which was empty, and my auntie gifted to me. I have this 100-year-old auntie which is super alive. Another example, we can talk a whole awakening call about her. Very special, very special person. She's turning 100 this year in July. Domi, we all love her, and she was like, oh, of course, you know, you can just. I know what you are doing. I know you are like doing this experiment. So I wanna offer you this help. I wanna offer the flat. So she hadn't been renting it for 3 or 4 years, and then she decided, yeah, you just use it. And you don't have to give me any money. So that's one example. But I think if you look at the statistics, you can see that. You can see that we throw away so much food. We throw away so many resources. So by helping, but by fixing these connections, heart-to-heart connections, I think a lot of possibilities emerge.
Yeah. And what I hear you saying these many to many connections, which I think was the theme of Gandhi 3.0 this year. Can you tell us a little more about that, of how you guys had brought this into discussion, this theme of many to many, and how it's also coming into your work and how you're also viewing change moving forward?
Yeah, I mean this is all service state wisdom, which is beautiful. I feel we talk about this concept of leadership, where in the times of Gandhi, you know, he was one big leader and everyone was listening, and a lot of things happened, of course, with that model. And I'm not very dogmatic in this sense. I think we still need to speak out, and if we have a voice, we need to talk. You know, if we feel that we have to share something, sometimes we will stand in that leadership position, and I think it's beautiful, you know. But at the same time, we are seeing these models which are more based on the collective, and where, for example, in a gathering of 50 people, if one person is talking, then you'll have those 50 connections. But if 50 people are sharing and connections are created between each other, then a lot of more possibilities emerge after that event. And I have seen that. I have seen that in the Gandhi 3.0, for example, in India. I saw that in a conference last year about solidarity and social economy in Spain. And in that gathering was all about conferences. But we had the chance to offer a circle. And there were like maybe 10 activities at the same time, but almost 50% of the people, so many people came to our circle because they wanted the circle. They wanted to see each other's faces. They wanted to share. And I think that's a collective intelligence which wants to emerge. And everyone was so happy just to share few words of about the weekend they were having, about the learning. So I think that sense of many to many, you know, that we can always do more together than just one person. So I feel that. I really connect with that. But again, I also feel we need to stand up if we feel like, you know. So the answer is lies always inside.
Go ahead, Rina.
No, I just had one question and then I'll hand it over to you. But you had talked about standing up and having a voice. And I know you've been writing, which is something we haven't touched on yet. And so you write about your experiences to share with the communities that you're a part of around the world, and also, especially your communities in Spain. Is that one of the ways that you feel that you're giving a voice to this important work that you think needs to be done?
I think sharing and reflecting back, you know, I think it's part of this new paradigm of leadership, which we call leadership. I think it's very nice, right? I mean, when you, for example, when you leave a retreat, I think there are so many stories that come up, and I feel it's very nice to share it with more people that maybe couldn't be there. And I think the whole storytelling culture, I think it's something that is very useful nowadays. I feel, for example, in organizations like Manasadna, one of the transitions I could see there is from this control to trust. So, and for example, in many organizations, all we do is based on control. Like you have a boss and he will control or she will control what you do. And in Manasadna context, for example, it was much more about trusting. And this trusting was built upon stories, you know, because every day they would gather and they would share stories about their work and inspiration or whatever happened to them or whatever came to their heart. So it was very surprising the first time I was in India how I was thinking like, oh, what is the controlling here? What is the managing here, you know? And I could feel there was a lot of sense of trust and a lot of sense of we are going to focus on building a culture through stories. So I think that's the power of stories, storytelling, not only online, but also offline. I think that the writing online is part of that. How can we build that culture that we want? And stories, I think, is a very, very useful tool.
Well, I want to build on that, Josetta. So in addition to the writing, I'm curious to hear your reflections about language, because you've chosen to live in a place in India where I believe your language command is certainly not your first language, or I think your second language, or maybe your third language. And your goal was to love, right? You weren't there as an expat. And so I'm curious what you've learned through grappling with language barrier and still connecting with people so deeply as you do.
I think, I mean, language is there, maybe not the verbal language, but we are always communicating in different ways. And I think they say, you know, I think there are some scientists that say that most of our communication happens without words. So the way we look or the way we touch people, I think that's also communication. Like how I was saying about Jashvai, how even if he was not speaking, I could feel his love, you know. So in India, it was a chance to try to connect with people without the verbal language, and using all other kinds of languages. What I was saying, I think that little touch here and there, or a hug, or just looking in their eyes. So I actually like that. It's kind of a game to try to connect with people without the language, with that language barrier.
I love it. I love it. I want to ask a more pointed question, because there's many ways to look at the world, and this is a friendly perspective of saying, yeah, of course we want to walk towards love and compassion, and there's a lens that says, Josera, this is really nice, but it's also, a waste of time. You've been well educated in the main system of the world. You could be running some major organization, having some leveraged path to make a big difference and to support the causes that you care about. So I'm curious what you'd say to that. What leads you to purposefully not walk on that path that is well-traveled, that people think is the way that would make the world a better place?
Yeah. It's actually still a life doubt, which is alive. I think I'm finding my way in that sense. I don't have a final answer to it. I definitely feel that cultivating myself has been the priority last year. And it's, for now, it's manifesting in maybe these small experiments. And I feel it's of value for me right now. This is the place where I want to see myself. And I can see, that they are not two different things, actually. Because, for example, if you think of the concept of the ripples, we were having a retreat the other day, and one person who is working for a company, he's like one of the bosses of the company, he came to the retreat, and he was very moved by these small acts and this sense of connection. And after the retreat, he went back to the work, and he had this experience where usually he has to say people, oh, you have been late. And usually he does it in not in the kindest way. I was surprised that he was reflecting that. And he said that day, he was not able to do it like that. He changed. Like he said, I had to be kind. I came with that energy that I had to be kind. I saw the situation in a completely different way. So you might say, okay, this is a very small act, but how that act changed the dynamic in that day, and how in the long term it's giving him an example, for example, to think in general on the way how he relates with his employees, for example. And we know of many cases where people after a retreat, they start, for example, 21 days kindness challenge or so many things that go deeper into that first experience. So for now, I'm cultivating these small spaces, but I can also see the greatness of it. But I'm not, at the same time, I'm not close to, for example, building a bigger organization. It's not something I've completely dismissed. So yeah, it's an open question. It's an open question for me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Josera, for all that you do and for answering these questions so wholeheartedly and so generously. We had one question that just came in, and then I think I'll hand it off to Virju. Is that okay? I just saw it come in.
Sure.
What is one small practical step that a person in the USA can do daily to foster a more loving presence?
And that's from Birdie in Texas.
Yes.
I think there are many, many different ways. I think meditating is a beautiful act of love. I never say, oh, you should meditate. But I think I was very, when I started to read about neuroscience and how we can actually change our brain, and how can all the qualities that we want to develop, we can actually develop through small practices. So, I think maybe you can choose a value and say I'm going to try to develop that maybe through meditation or through changing myself in some way. So I'm not very good at giving advice, but yeah, there are so many things you can try. You know, there are these challenges that I was talking about, which you can find in the website kindspring.org. And for 21 days, you can just perform a small act of kindness, from, like, for example, giving a cake to a stranger or to give flowers to your neighbor, or you can hug some people in the street, as we're saying, or you can do many, many small things like that.
Thank you. So before I hand it off to Birju for closing, I just wanted to thank Josera for bringing all these values. I think so many of the values we learn about from Gandhiji or Vinoba Bhave or Cesar Chavez are very much alive in the world today. And I think one of the people that is really living these values and living these true values of a love warrior, as Josera will say, is very much alive in Josera's life and the communities that he's a part of and his presence. So I just wanted to thank you for that. And I'll hand it off to Birju for closing now. Thank you.
Thank you, Rina. Thank you.
Thank you, Rina. It's a wonderful process of sharing. And thank you, Josera, for what you're living in life and you're spending time with us. And we'd love to invite everyone to share their gratitude as well. But before we do that, we would love to close our call with a minute of silence to practice gratitude from a more distilled space within us. And then I will take us all off mute after that. 1 minute of silence. Thank you very much. And on the count of three, I'd love to invite us all to say thank you, Josera. One, two, and three. Thank you, Josera.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.